But surely all this becomes very boring after a time? I asked.
Yes, it does, he said.
Then the people look for something more satisfying in life, as you will see, for when their particular desire is no more, they are able to change to something else, and get what they want. Many people are perfectly happy with this Arcadian existence, particularly those who have had rather a hard time during their earth life. Such people often spend 90% of their astral existence under these conditions, where they have the friends, pets, beautiful houses and gardens which satisfy them, and only pass on to the mental world when they are more or less forced to do so, by the urge of their egos, who wish to progress along the path of evolution. My guide now told me to hold his hand again and join with him in willing to pass from this second sphere to the third. I did as I was told. At once the scene that surrounded us started to dim and gradually gave place to a new one. Our surroundings were now quite different, for we were standing in an open space, surrounded by what appeared to be dozens of small woods or coppices. If you can imagine a gigantic park with trees everywhere, with glades and dells intermingled with the clumps of trees, it will help you to visualize the scenery. There is nothing quite like it in our world, but I should imagine that from above it would appear as if one were over a gigantic Sherwood forest. In many cases the open spaces were several square acres in extent, varying from a glade measuring perhaps 3 acres to open spaces covering what I would estimate to be a 50-acre field. All these glades were very picturesque, as everywhere there were flowering shrubs, while daffodils and forget-me-nots bloomed in profusion in the green grass. There were no houses to be seen at first, but later I saw odd houses, very large ones too, resembling the huge halls or manor houses that one finds in England and which in the old days were inhabited by the rich aristocrats or squires of the county in which they were found. We glided along and I saw that in many of these open spaces groups were congregated. We approached one of these groups and found that there were perhaps 100 people watching an artist painting a picture, on a canvas that measured about 50 by 30 feet. They were obviously enthralled by what they were watching, for no one took any notice of us as we joined the group. The artist was not using brushes, but he had in his hand a long stick resembling a fishing rod, and as he pointed the stick at different parts of the canvas, a picture appeared. First in rough outline, then later in detail. As he painted, the artist spoke from time to time, explaining what he was creating. He made quite clear the impression that he wished those watching to have, and on one occasion, he rubbed out part of the painting. I cannot use any other word for, as he pointed the stick, a portion of the picture was erased, and explained that his previous thought form had not been sufficiently detailed to get the effect he wanted. Again he seemed to concentrate. The rod moved up, down and across, a new detail which blended in with the rest of the painting, that immediately took form, and the second attempt at once emphasized the point he had made a minute or so before. I could not understand much of what the painter was talking about, for it was couched in technical terms only comprehensible to a brother artist. I was told that the artist was one of the great painters of the past. My guide stated that an artist would paint because the urge, which made him do so when in the world, continues after death. He does not have to use brushes and paint at this level, because he is able to express himself in color merely by projecting the thought. The fluidic astral matter answers to the thought form and the picture appears, as if by magic, as the thought develops. Although the canvas was huge compared with the pictures we have in our galleries in the world, it was in no way cumbersome to create a picture of that size at the astral level, when merely by concentrating on a particular part of the canvas, the picture within the mind of the artist came to life. I cannot describe the glorious colors of which that picture was composed, for we have no words to describe the many in-between colors that were used. When I mentioned that I saw at least 30 different shades of a color, which if I described any of them I would have to call red, you will realize how impossible it is to give anything but a very incomplete description of what I saw quite clearly. My guide explained that many of the great painters of the past who are still at the astral level,
lived in this sphere and that they spent their lives creating, in the form of pictures, the ideas with which their minds were filled. At the same time, the artists taught any who cared to watch and listen to them, the methods adopted in making pictures. I was told that it took only a few hours to create one of those huge pictures, and it often happened that the artist, having finished one, started at once to create another. But does the first one fade, once the artist has withdrawn his attention from the canvas? I asked. No, replied my friend, it remains just as you see it now, so long as anyone is looking at it. You see, once a picture is created in astral matter, that picture remains static for anyone to see, so long as a single thought is concentrated on it. When all thought is withdrawn from it, then it gradually disintegrates into the main astral atmosphere and is lost forever, or until a new thought creates it again as a new picture. I watched until the picture was finished, fascinated by the skill of the creator and the results achieved. When the artist had moved away and was talking to some of the crowd who had been sitting round watching him, I saw that several of the other watchers, obviously students of art, started to create something similar for themselves, taking the master picture, if I may call it that, as their pattern. I still watched and saw immediately the tremendous difference between their efforts and those of the great painter. It was explained to me that the reason for such a great difference was the lack of knowledge of the student compared with the knowledge of the master. The students were unable to express in clear thought what they wanted to appear on the canvas, so the results were decidedly amateurish. Obviously, the canvas would only exhibit what they were able to express in thought, and I saw very clearly why that was so. Even in the picture galleries of this world, if one looks at a picture, it often happens that one is able to feel something of what the artist has endeavored to express. Such feeling is emphasized 1,000 times at the astral level, and looking at the great painting, I knew without any shadow of doubt what this artist wished to express in color and form. We moved off and saw many groups surrounding individuals doing similar work, but as the country was slightly undulating, it was practically impossible to see any two of them at one time. In one of the valleys where a slowly moving stream trickled along, there was a group seated on its bank, seemingly doing nothing. As we approached, however, I realized that this group was not watching a creative artist, but was producing sounds resembling a beautiful symphony played by one of our world-famous orchestras. I did not hear anything until we got quite close to the group. Then I found that the surrounding air was filled with the most beautiful music I had ever heard. In the center of the group was a man whose face seemed familiar to me, yet I knew that I had never met him in real life. I asked my guide who he was, and he whispered, "That is the celebrated Johann Strauss." At that moment he was demonstrating how the sound of trickling water can be expressed in music. I remember that it was Strauss who had composed the Blue Danube, and this music seemed to have much of the lilt found in that hackneyed but beautiful waltz. It was even more beautiful still, I should say. Whilst I stood enthralled, I saw on the opposite bank of the stream what appeared to be ethereal figures, which in some way were part of the symphonic poem that I heard. My friend told me to look at these new people, for these are members of the parallel evolution I have told you about, the Deva Kingdom, he said. But what are they doing? I asked. And why do they look different from the crowds that are on our side of the stream? It was explained that they look different because they were indeed different. They are more ethereal, because, being part of a different evolution, their bodies are different and, although made of astral matter, are at the same time less concrete than our astral bodies. I was told that these were some of the music devas, those beings who live and express themselves through sound, and that they were helping the composer who was seated on our side of the stream to express himself as he wished to do. Just how they helped I cannot say, for they never spoke, but seemed to concentrate on their creator of the music and, through their thoughts, enabled him to express in more and more detail what he endeavored to create in sound. Volume of sound was there and every note clearly heard, but I found that when we passed from the group to a distance of perhaps 50 yards, nothing was to be heard at all. It is difficult to describe these members of the Deva kingdom in words that are understandable. Their forms were beautiful, but as they moved they seemed to vaporize. When they became still again they were once more quite definite in shape. I think I can describe it best by saying that the bodies seemed to be made of mist, which only held together in a concrete way when the individuals remained more or less still. We went over to the opposite bank, but as we approached these people they seemed to glide away, rather like shy animals. They had no fear of us, but did not invite contact at all, and I felt that if we approached them with the intent to communicate with them, how that would be done I had no idea then, they would have vanished into thin air. My Indian friend said that this impression was in a way fairly accurate. On my guide beckoning me to follow him, we moved on. Soon I saw that he was making for one of the large buildings, which I had taken to be, huge manor house. As we drew nearer I saw that the architecture was very beautiful indeed, and deep French windows overlooked the surrounding countryside. Spacious lawns gradually sloped away from the house, which was situated on the top of a rise. Flowers and flowering shrubs bloomed on all sides, and in the distance, perhaps 10 miles away, the sea could be seen if one looked carefully. It was a delightful spot. I wondered who lived here and for what purpose. We came down to earth on the terrace and entered the wide doors that led into a spacious hall, furnished as I would have expected it to be, but with one remarkable difference, that in the hall there were actually small trees and plants, principally roses I noticed, blooming indoors with the roots growing through the floor. There was no artificiality in this, in fact one felt one was in an indoor garden, and the result to the eye was very pleasing indeed. No one seemed to be about and there were no sounds of occupation, but my guide immediately led me to one of the doors that opened from the hall, and as the door opened, sounds of music met my ear. There was only one occupant of the room, and he was playing a grand piano in a way, which showed that he was no mean exponent of the art. He took no notice of us but continued to play, and we listened, fascinated by the power of the musician over his instrument. There were a few very inviting easy chairs in which we sat down, and perhaps for a quarter of an hour the playing continued. As time passed, I seemed to recognize a similarity in this music to the Chopin preludes, and in a whisper to my friend I asked who the musician was. "Do not you recognize him?" he replied. "That is the famous Chopin, who is still expressing his great soul through the medium of sound, in exactly the same way as he used to do when he was alive. You will notice, though, that he does not look delicate here, for when he was in the world, he suffered much and for a great part of his lifetime he was not a fit man. Now all that is changed, here fatigue cannot trouble him and he produces more and more beautiful music, at times, he allows other musicians to hear. At this level there are concerts all the time. Thus there is never any difficulty in attending these functions, if you are really interested and are able to appreciate the beauty in nature that the musician is endeavoring to express in sound." I looked at the performer more closely and found that I was unable to recognize any resemblance to likeness of the great musician, which I had seen, but my memory of these was vague and probably I had not studied them very carefully. He stopped playing after a time and turned round to us, in no way perturbed or annoyed by our presence. He assumed that we were music lovers, so explained to us what he had been trying to express, and although he used some technical terms, I was fascinated by what he said. He emphasized that in his opinion every sound was a description of either color or movement. Progressions and blending of chords were sound pictures of beautiful gardens, and where cadenzas appeared, one should immediately feel the presence of a slowly moving stream, perhaps between two perfectly laid out gardens, and try to see the picture that the musician was endeavoring to express. I, who considered myself musical, at once realized how little I knew of the true art, and resolved that after death I would be one of those people who took up the study of music in a big way. It is unfortunate that, in the world, these masters of music are in most cases entirely outside the scope and opportunity of the average man who has to earn a living. We left as we had come, without any official leave taking, and, as we withdrew, Chopin turned towards his piano and recommenced to play. As we closed the door, we were again in the passage. No sound whatever came through the door. There was only the sound of birds, many of which in diverse colors flitted about, not only in the garden, but indoors also. My friend told me that this huge place was one of the great art schools which existed this level of the astral world, and that hundreds of the permanent inhabitants of this world spend most of their time learning something of the art, in which they are particularly interested. I was told that tuition was always available, for all the great masters are willing to teach those who are anxious to learn, and that the opportunity is there at all times, for there is no night or day, and fatigue does not enter into one's calculations. But surely, I asked, people do not carry on studying and practicing day and night, week after week, month after month and year after year in this way? Yes, they do. And as I have told you, they do not get tired nor does time hang heavily when they are interested and enthralled in what they are doing. If you analyze your reactions at the physical level, you will find that time never drags when you are doing what you want to do. Usually fatigue enters in and you have to stop, even though you are enjoying what you are doing, but here that does not apply, as no one gets tired and there is no time as we understand that term. You do not have to get home for dinner. You have no wife waiting for you and you have no duties or responsibilities in any way. Those limitations just do not exist at the astral level, so the man or the woman carries on with the work or relaxation that he or she desires, without any thought of how much time can be devoted to that particular form of study or enjoyment. My guide then told me that he had a little work to do, and politely asked my permission to leave me for a short while. Go where you will. He said, no one will interfere with you and I suggest you wander in and out of different rooms, for I can assure you, you will not meet with any hostile reception. This building is very like similar ones, which exist here, and it will be well worthwhile for you to see more of what is done in such places. I shall return when I have finished my private work and I do not think you will be bored whilst I am away. From the outside I had seen that the building had at least three stories, so I decided that I would explore a little, as he suggested. To start with I went into some of the lower rooms. In one I found a sculptor with a class of pupils, explaining how a particular curve could be obtained. I stood a while listening to his discourse and some of his pupils, without speaking, smiled at me and I listened, obviously not objecting in the least to my presence. In another room, a quartet was practicing, in another a single violinist was going over and over a particular passage, with a score of music in front of him. It was very similar to an academy such as I had seen in the world, but with the great difference that there was no fuss or hurry and that all forms of art were represented. Also it was very noticeable that the people concerned, although quite seriously studying, were so obviously happy and not tense in any way. Like the students I saw the last time in the Royal Academy of Music in England. Later I wandered upstairs and here I had a very pleasant surprise. As I opened a door, and I noted with interest that here one did open a door and did not go through it as one would with physical doors, and went into one of these rooms, I saw a girl seated on a settee near to an open grand piano. She had a piece of music in her hand, which she was studying. As I entered she looked up and at once I knew her, for she was Daphne Heer whom I had last seen in England in 1935 when I met her at a golf club. The man who was my opponent that day, knew her intimately, he introduced us and we soon got into conversation. I saw her many times during my leave and we got to know each other extremely well. I had thought several times of asking her to marry me, for I imagined I was in love with her. But somehow I did not. For a reason, I did not feel that I had yet enough money to marry on. Also I wanted to get to the top of my profession before I accepted the responsibility of a wife. I returned to Ceylon and for 2 years we corresponded regularly, then it all ended by her contracting pneumonia and to my great regret. Her mother wrote to me to say that she had died. I wrote a letter of sympathy and gradually lost touch with the family. And now, there was Daphne before me, seemingly very much alive and looking just the same as when I had seen her last, but with an even happier expression. In fact, her whole face radiated joy and contentment, and some of the joy, I flattered myself, was at seeing me. "Daphne, my dear, is it really you?"
"Yes, it is I," she said, "but what are you doing here?
You haven't left the old world yet, I know, so what has brought you here?" I tried to explain to her something of what had happened and why I was here. She said she was surprised to see me because, although most people who are evolved, at all wander on the astral plane during the time that their bodies are asleep and recuperating for the following day, yet it is not common for living people to visit the third sphere of the astral world. In most cases they do not know how to get there, and very few know of the existence of these different levels, but darling, she said, now you are here, you will be able to come again and we must see lots of each other in the future, there is much that I can show you. Although you never asked me to marry you when I was alive, I knew that you loved me, and I love you too. I then realized that it had not seemed strange at all for her to address me as darling, for I had so often called her that in the old days and she me, and although all that was several years ago, it came back in a flash and I felt again the same draw towards her, the same thrill at being in her company as I had felt in those old days. "Apostrophe, this is wonderful," I said, "and it certainly will not be my fault if I do not see a great deal of you in the future. Perhaps you will be able to help me in this, for I do not know whether I could get here on my own, even though it all seemed so easy this time when I had a guide to help." I told her about my efforts in the recent past and how, apart from my first astral journey, I had not yet been able to bring anything through, even though I had tried very hard to do so. "In future I shall want to remember what we say and do. I wonder if I shall be able to do that." As I said these words, my Indian friend came into the room. "So you have found each other," he said, "I thought you would, if I left you long enough. It is just as well that you have found Daphne, for she can be of great assistance to you, and through your love for each other, many things may now be possible that were difficult before. For one thing, you will have a definite contact at this level, which you can concentrate upon as soon as you get out of your body at the moment of falling asleep. Your thinking of Daphne will immediately make itself known to her, for thought is a very powerful thing, and concentrated thought is not bound by different levels of matter, so Daphne, if she will allow me to call her by that name, will know quite definitely when you concentrate your thoughts on her, in just the same way as people know that you want them when you ring them up on the telephone. Daphne cannot easily come to meet you when you get out of your physical body, and are on the lowest or first sphere of this world, but she can be your contact for passing from that first sphere to the third sphere, where you are now, in exactly the same way that holding my hand acted as a contact for you when I told you to will that you passed first from the lowest to the second, and later on from the second to the third sphere. You will find that by the exercise of your will, plus having a contact who knows the ropes, there will be no difficulty at all." He continued, "You see, you do not know very much about the law of karma yet, the law that to a great extent makes your contacts and gives you the opportunities which are so important to your evolution. This law of karma, or law of cause and effect as it is usually called in Christian countries, deals with every word, thought and action of yours at the physical level. The mere fact of your having given affection at that level to Daphne and of her having returned that affection, even though it did not come to the natural fruition of what the world calls marriage, means that you two have a link with each other, which sooner or later you must work out. There is a great deal to be said for the state of being in love, for whilst a person is in that state, or even imagines himself to be in that state, he wants to give and for a short period does not seek to get anything in return for what he gives. Expressed differently, he exudes something that can be said to be the highest he can offer. That giving is a cause, which must produce an effect. In other words, the law of karma must work its natural way. A real exchange of love makes an ideal partnership for progress in anything, for each one is only too willing and anxious to help the other in any way possible,
So I welcome this contact of yours and I do not mind admitting that I hoped you would make it. I could not bring you here deliberately, for that would have been interfering with the natural working out of the law of karma I mentioned. Presumably it was your fate to meet again under these different conditions, and it is now up to you both to take advantage of the force of circumstances that has made this linking up possible. How fascinating is the working of God, of fate. Had Charles not been killed, you would not have been so miserable that I was detailed to come and help you. Now, through your efforts to understand something of the evolutionary plan, you have been allowed to meet again a person whom you thought you had lost forever, or lost for the remainder of your physical life. I cannot guarantee that on a morning following a joint astral plane expedition, you will always recall all your experiences, for the development of a perfect memory, covering what you do when you are out of your physical body, requires much practice and so far you are only a very young pupil. I shall help you to remember what you have seen tonight and when you write out your report of the night's happenings, you will realize how important it is to bring back into the physical brain cells the result of your wanderings. You will probably make a great effort in the future, which will gradually enable you to have the continuity of consciousness that is so essential. The mere fact that you have found someone in the astral world whom you were fond of in the physical world, will encourage you to make Herculean efforts to overcome your limitations. Daphne can help you a great deal, too, for having lived at this level for some years, she knows the power of thought, she knows too what can be done at the astral level and what cannot be done there. If you continue your efforts to remember what you do whilst out of your physical body at night, you will be able to carry on a second existence, as it were a life which you lead only when your physical body is asleep. Daphne then took up the conversation by turning to my friend, Bhattacharya. She said, "As you say, I can be of great use to Henry now. Why was here you two? Do you know each other? You called my friend Acharya and he has never even told I not able to link up with him before. I tried so hard after I came to this plane, but even in the early days, when I was living on the first sphere of this world, I did not seem to be able to make any impression on him." Before he could answer, I interrupted and said, "Look me his name, though I have seen so much of him the last few days. Is your name Acharya?" "Yes and no," my Indian friend replied. "It is certainly part of my name, and I am usually called that, by those who have contact with me at this level. It is good enough for our purpose, so you two may call me by that name if you wish, but you soon realize that the names by which people are known in the world, at any rate the surnames, are not so important after all. You, Daphne, could not get in touch with Henry, do you, Henry? Realize that this is the first time that I have mentioned your name, because he was not yet awake in the occult or spiritual sense, consequently he did not remember anything of what he had done out of his body, apart from stray dreams that were extremely muddled and incomplete. Therefore when next he left his body, he had no concentrated plan and thought of what he wished to do. You talked to him, I know, but as you say, he did not seem as interested as when you talked to him in the physical world, when you expected him to remember what you had talked about a few nights previously. He seemed vague and dull. That was because he was not awake. It required some great tragedy, such as the death of his well-loved brother Charles, to make him clamor for light, for occult knowledge. There had to be a crisis, for through this, the urge to know is born. What a man really wants, he can get, providing he is willing and eager to work. "Knock and it shall be open to you, seek and ye shall find," said the great master, the Christ, and those words are literally true. But now we must get on, for I have more to show you before it is time for you to return to your body. Perhaps you, Daphne, would care to come with us?
I would indeed, said Daphne, for I know that with your knowledge and help I can go to places which I cannot yet visit with my limited knowledge.
First have a look at your watch, Acharya said to me, and see how much time has elapsed since you left your body. I looked, and found that the face of my watch was strangely blurred. I tried to imagine what the time would be and each time I thought, the hands of my watch changed to synchronize with my thought. I'm afraid I don't know, I replied, for my watch seems to change the hour with each thought that passes through my head.